The Twitter card question last time had to do with the lecture, and we were talking about this notion Paul Rudolph had that in architecture all problems can never be solved. In fact, it's a nature of practice in the 20th century when he was working that architects choose what aspects of a building they want to solve. And if we solve more problems, our buildings would be far less potent. Therefore, we need to choose some things and ignore some other aspects of a building. So for the Twitter card question, I ask you, well, what do you think about that position? And on a scale of 1 to 10, where 1 was, I think that stinks. I think that's ridiculous. I don't agree with that at all. And 10 is, I'm all in. I get it. I agree with Paul Rudolph. So here are some of those responses. There were a number of people who said 1, for example. Someone says, number 1, I do not agree with Paul Rudolph. I think everything in life is all about balance, and architecture should reflect that as well, because of the influence a building has on the people who inhabit it. Leave the intense concentrations on one area to forms of art that won't directly negatively affect people's lives and the environment. Someone else says, number 1, Mr. Rudolph may be a respected man and architect, but a single simplistic approach to architecture is the equivalent of me going into an architecture test and saying, oh, I'm just going to focus on slide IDs. Sure, I may do well and ace that specific aspect, but ultimately I will fail the overall test, the same way many of the buildings we looked at today have somewhat failed in their duties. Someone else says, number 1, buildings should not be made like this. I think it compromises the integrity of a building when the architect focuses on one quality. What makes a building beautiful is how it works as a whole and how it interacts with humans. This ensures viability in the building. Then there was a good distribution in between the extremes. One person said, I give Paul Rudolph's idea a 4. I believe buildings need to be beautiful and inspiring, and that to do this, sometimes compromises have to be made. However, I believe that a building should be dedicated to its underlying purpose first and foremost. Things like the Lu Khan Hospital, giving up beds to make the building look better, that's absurd. It is at this point where there really needs to be a questioning of intentions. Someone else says, I'm a 5. An architect cannot solve all issues. No human can. The only thing to take into consideration when contemplating Rudolph's comment is whether the building creates more problems than it solves. A structure should not be inconsiderate to the people who are affected by it and interact with it. People do that to other people enough. Someone else says, I'm a 6. I don't completely agree with the notion that buildings can only solve a few problems. I do recognize that there is no perfect building and that certain qualities come at the expense of others. However, I believe architects can do a better job of balancing the function, form, and physical considerations of their work than is suggested here. Someone else says, I'm a 7. I agree with Paul Rudolph's ideology. I believe in architecture there are times when you have to ignore certain necessities or elements in order to give the building meaning. Finally, someone says, I'm a 10. Architecture is meant to be exploratory and to test the limits of form. Breaking a comfort zone invariably has consequences, but these cons do not outweigh the pros. Architecture must be bold and humanistic, and sometimes we fail, but we must try. Good range of positions on that idea of Paul Rudolph. So today, in some ways, we're extending that discussion. I mentioned last time, you know, how do you deal with this myriad of issues in architecture? One way is to do it like Paul Rudolph suggested. Select one or a few aspects of the building, concentrate on those, ignore other aspects of the building. And I mentioned last time that, in a way, This is connected to intellectual thought. In the late 20th century versus our own time in 2016. And you know, this is, we'll talk a little more about this Thursday, but this is in a way what a course like this is meant to do, to make you to think about culture, to make you think about society. I mean, the name of the course is Architecture and Society. And occasionally I'll get a student who says, wait, that lecture you just gave, that wasn't really an architecture lecture. That was about something else. I signed up for this class. I thought this was an architecture class. And I tell them, architecture and society. This one was about the society side of it. That's important too. And we're always looking at that interaction of architecture and society. So what in society might have changed from the 1970s, when Paul Rudolph made that statement, to 2016. And in fact, there are cultural anthropologists and sociologists who would say that in that period there's been an enormous shift in societal attitudes, especially societal attitudes maybe as regards these issues. So let me just throw a few things out here. There is a notion of modernism versus postmodernism. Modernism really being the latter part of the 20th century. That's when it hit its heyday. And postmodernism maybe being even the 90s, early 2000s, the period we're in now, as somehow different from the modern period. And in the modern period, there was this notion that there was an answer. There was a freaking answer to problems. Sometimes, and I mentioned this a bit last time, that someone like Einstein sort of seeking the singular overarching theory that will explain everything. Just as sort of word dichotomies, one normally thinks of modern thinking as seeking the truth. We're going to find the truth, and it's going to be clear, and it's going to be singular. Postmodern thinking tends to say, you know, it's more about values. It's more about beliefs. And it's not just about the truth. There isn't a simple truth. Truths are interpreted through values and beliefs. That's a postmodern attitude. A modern attitude would be the notion of idealization. There is somehow this ideal, this perfection that we're aiming for. But postmodern thinking would be more about relativism. You know, in certain circumstances, this is extraordinary. In another circumstance, something else is extraordinary. There's not an ideal. There's not that singular perfect ideal out there. Things are much more relativistic than that. In modern thinking, we generally seek order. There's some kind of clarity. There's some kind of resolution of everything. In postmodern thinking, we're a little more interested in reality. And reality's messy, and reality's complex, and it's not so completely ordered. We generally think of modern thinking seeking a kind of utopia, resolving everything kind of just right, and everything's utopian. But postmodern thinking is much more about everyday life. It's much more about today. No, there's not a utopia. No, things aren't perfect. We're much more interested in the everyday journey, the everyday experience of life. Modern thinking is generally thought to be more rational, logical, analytical. Postmodern thinking acknowledges there's an emotional side of people that just freaking flies in the face of rationality. So, there's a whole lecture I give in my graduate seminar about, you know, modern thinking and postmodern thinking, and I ask everybody in the class, where do you lie? Are you more a modern thinker? Are you more a postmodern thinker? Because this is a real thing that society has been grappling with for several decades now. And it comes out in film. There's modern film and there's postmodern film. And it comes out in literature. There's modern literature and there's postmodern literature. And it comes out in architecture. There's a modern way to approach these architectural issues. And there's a postmodern way to approach these issues. So another thing that I think has been very prevalent in 21st century thinking is this whole notion of synergy or combinatory things. So, we used to, in the modern era, we had a telephone, and a telephone did a very, very specific thing, and it did it really well. And then we had our stereo, and it played music, and it honestly, it did it really, really well. And then we had our watch, our clock that told time, and it was right here, and it did that very, very well. And then we had our calendar that we kept in a little book, and it did that very, very well. And then we had our TV, and then we had libraries, and we had mail, and all those things that were individual things, and they did those things singularly and very well. And then along came a digital device like this, and it does all of it. It does mail, and it does TV and video, and it does phone, and it does calendar, and it does all those things. Honestly, sometimes it compromises a little bit to do all those. I was trying to do a really important phone call in the airport in Denver yesterday afternoon, and I could have freaking stomped this thing to death because the sound is just not that good. It's not like it is on a landline. And in an airport where there's lots of ambient noise around and I'm trying to really hear everybody on the phone calls, nuances in their voice, you ain't getting it with this. But it does all those things. And it does them all pretty damn well. And we sacrifice maybe that perfection of one element in order to get the kind of synergy or synthesis that comes with these more complex, more postmodern devices. If you look at any kind of cinema or television or entertainment or video game, the difference between a version done in 1950 or 1960 at the beginning of modernism and a version done in 2014, 15, 16, it's an enormous, enormous change in just our attitude toward the way we absorb information and entertainment. Way back in the 50s, there was this TV show called Dragnet. Probably none of you have ever seen this TV show, but it was the beginning of cops and robbers television, which, of course, has been a huge genre. I mean, I don't know, probably 40 or 50% of all TV shows ever made are about crime. And Dragnet was the beginning of that. But in Dragnet, there were like 5 characters. That's all. Really simple. Hour-long TV show, 5 characters. You knew them all extremely well. You saw them once a week for an hour, and you knew all 5 of those characters really well. And the plots were very simple. There was a beginning, there was a middle, there was a conclusion. And it just followed that plot line just really linearly right straight through the TV program. It was not complicated. It was very direct storytelling via TV. If you compare Dragnet to something like Breaking Bad, and Breaking Bad is similarly it's a crime show, but oh my God, I don't know, there's like 60 characters in Breaking Bad, and they come in and they come out, and some episodes focus on one, and some episodes focus on another. That never happened in Dragnet. It was the same 5 people. You saw them over and over again doing exactly what you knew they were supposed to do. In Breaking Bad, it's like you have to have a little scorecard almost. I mean, or you have it in your head, but you kind of know all these people that weave in and out. And then the plot line, it's episodic. There'll be a little bit about this plot line, then whoop, we're over here, and we're about this plot line, then whoop, we're over here, and we're back over to another plot line. So that all those things we have to, in our head, weave those together and sort out the plot lines. But we're good at that. We know how to do that. There is not often this simple resolution of things. There aren't good characters and bad characters. Sometimes this really evil, wicked person who's a crack, he's making crack in his lab there. Jesus, horrible thing to do. But we love him. We feel sympathetic. We're kind of, on his side. That never happened in Dragnet. We had the good guys and the bad guys, okay? And that was pretty clear. This is the difference between a modern world, a modern society, modern thinking, and postmodern thinking. I am just on the last 50 pages of the fifth book in the Game of Thrones series. I'm finally freaking done with that thing. But that is so freaking, so completely postmodern. Oh my God, there have to be 1,500 characters in those five books. And all of them have incredibly complex names that you can barely read it, much less remember it. And then a character is liable to be called five different things. Sometimes she's Dany, sometimes she's Daenerys, sometimes she's the Dragon Queen. You know that, and he's just like, you're going to remember not only the 1,500 characters, but the three versions of all of their names, and all of the. And then you're constantly you're episodic, hitting. You know, we're in Meereen, and it's hot and it's desert, and then the next minute, boom, we're back at the wall and it's freezing cold, and we're just constantly back and forth and back and forth. That is postmodern storytelling. That is the way our brains work. And it's come from digital devices and the internet and this sort of episodic experience of life that is part of the postmodern world. Now, of course, architecture is going to respond to that. Of course, it has to respond to that because architecture is tied to society. So what is the difference between approaching the myriad of architectural issues like Paul Rudolph did in the 1970s and approaching the myriad of architectural issues if you're an architect practicing in 2016 and you're thinking in a more postmodern way? And I would make the argument that there is a way to deal with this myriad of architectural issues in a postmodern way that is freaking wonderful. It's like a godsend. Modernism was okay, that was one way of doing it, but it caused some issues. Whereas this more postmodern approach, I think, can be extremely fruitful and very, very interesting in the breadth of accounting for architectural issues that can occur when you think in this way, when you create in this way, when you imagine and you tell stories in this way. So could we have the lights down? And we're going to look at just three buildings today. And I'm just saying, these are buildings that did not do what Paul Rudolph suggested. These are buildings that I think are trying to smash together all of these issues and kind of consider them all at once and not ignore any aspects of the building, and to try to get a kind of synergy out of dealing with one, two, three, five things all at the same time. So the first one we're looking at here is the de Young Museum in San Francisco. The architects are Herzog and Dimron. This is a Swiss firm, and they are they're practicing very heavily right now. They're sort of at the peak of their career. Very, very well-respected current architects. This is in Golden Gate Park in San Francisco. Just maybe as a little aside here. So we almost got a museum by this architect in about 99 or so. The university was contemplating building a new museum, what eventually became the Blanton Museum. They went through this very complicated process where they ask architects to submit their credentials to be considered to be architect for this building. They received about 80 submissions from some of the best architects in the world. There was a blue ribbon committee made up of arts people from across the state. They evaluated those submissions and they narrowed it down to eight architects. They brought those eight architects to the campus. There was a lecture by each architect. They showed their work. The committee interviewed them. They then narrowed it down to three architects. The committee went to visit the buildings by those three architects. They went to Finland. They went to Germany. They went to California. They went to Seattle. They went all over the world, you know, talking to clients of these people and trying to understand how can we make sure we've got the very best architect for our building. In the end, they selected Herzog and Dimron. And Herzog and Dimron did a fantastic initial scheme for that building. Honestly, amazing, amazing building. But the Board of Regents rejected that scheme. So they sent Herzog and Dimeron back to the drawing board, and they did a second scheme. And it was, in my estimation, maybe not quite as good as the first one, but it was amazing still, amazing building. They took that to the Regents. The Board of Regents rejected the second scheme that Herzog and Dimeron did. And then Herzog and Dimeron were pretty frustrated. They actually generated 12 options, just little vignettes of 12 different approaches to the building. And basically, again, the notion was, no, really, that's not what we have in mind. So we lost Herzog and Dimeron as the architects for that building. And there was some controversy over that at the time. It got to be a kind of front page news story in most of the newspapers in Texas. Then we did not hire Herzog, we lost Herzog and Dimeron. They then immediately went to do the de Young Museum in San Francisco. That was their next sort of big commission. It was amazingly comparable in scale, size, collection, and so on to the Blanton Museum. When they completed this building in 2005, Time Magazine did a two-page story on it, and they said it's the best building in the United States of the 21st century. And it was greatly lauded. They went on in 2008, they did the bird's nest at the Olympics in Beijing. And that one had enormous renown. They won the Pritzker Prize, which is the highest honor that any architect can get. It's like a Nobel Prize for architecture. And there was a guy who taught in the business school at the time. I parked in a parking lot by the business school, and I'd see this guy. He was a big dog. He was a really top business professor. I didn't really know him, but I knew who he was, and I'd see him occasionally in the parking lot. So one day I'm in the parking lot, and he comes over to me, and he says, "Spec, I want to know, this architect that we lost on the Blanton Museum because the Regents didn't like him, I want to know, is that the same architect that did this bird's nest that I'm seeing on TV all the time in the Olympics?" And I said, "Yeah, same architect." And he said, "God damn it!" Now, he wasn't so upset about the loss of the architecture, but he was upset that that UT did not get this world-class architect, you know, that now is like, you know, all over the Olympics and you know, international event focusing on this work they did in Beijing. Why didn't we get that on our campus? Very pissed off. But that just to give you a little background on Herzog and Dimeron and the origins of the Young Museum. There are, in fact, many characteristics of this building that were in that first scheme that they did for the Blanton Museum, which, alas, died an early death. So it's in Golden Gate Park. You know, we've talked about architecture being a part of its physical environment. That's part of physical considerations, merging with a landscape. It's in this beautiful soft park, and so on the left you can see how it becomes kind of an extension of the landscape in the park. On the right, there was a kind of formal garden that was there. There had been a building there previously that was a kind of Mediterranean-style building with red tile roofs and stone walls, and it had suffered very badly in an earthquake, and in fact had become structurally unsound and unsalvageable. So they had to tear it down and they built a new one. But there was this kind of formal garden in the front on the right. And so the museum both addresses the formal garden on one side, but then it becomes much more loose and much more organic shaped and much more integrated with the landscape of the park on the other side and the slide on the left. One of the really iconic elements of the building is this tower. So it's kind of long and low and addresses this formal garden in the slide on the left. And then out of that comes this tower. And I want us to just focus on the tower for a minute, and I would make the argument that it is equal parts issues of form, issues of physical considerations, and issues of human factors. So it got generated in part because the architects realized there is a freaking amazing view of the entire city of San Francisco if you get up a little bit on this site. So if you just get above the trees, because it's high on a hill in Golden Gate Park, when you get above the trees, you can see the Pacific Ocean on one side. You can see the Golden Gate Bridge going over to Sausalito. You can see the whole Bay Area. You can see the skyline of downtown San Francisco and the Transamerica Tower and all the iconic. You can see everything from this one spot because it's so high and because it's unobstructed because it's in this park. So they thought, for human factors, for just allowing people to have this opportunity to have this wonderful view, we should build the tower. We should build something up. So they took all of the functions of administration and some of the archival storage and things like that, and they stacked them in this tower. And then up at the top of that, where you can see right here, there gets to be a big observation deck, and you get that view. Now, that was also a huge draw to the museum because this is not the most famous collection ever, and it is in a slightly remote area. It's out in Golden Gate Park. It's not in downtown San Francisco. So how do you get people out here? Well, in part, you give them this freaking amazing view, and it's now become kind of legendary, and it's a destination because people go and they see the view and they see the museum as well. So it's human factors that's generating that tower. But there's another aspect. There is this whole earthquake thing that destroyed the other building. And, you know, in an earthquake-prone area, what you're really trying to do is resist lateral forces. So you're trying to cross-brace things. If you have a rectangle, you have an x-axis and a y-axis. But if you have this kind of twisted form like that, it actually negates the x and y axis, and you've got resistance in all directions much more. So structurally, just in terms of physical considerations, the twisting of that tower helped to resist some of these lateral loads that would have been problematic because it is an earthquake-prone area. And then, so I would say it's part human factors, it's part physical considerations, and it's also very much part form. It's making this sculptural object. It's making this landmark form that you can see from a long distance away. And people can identify that's the de Young Museum. It's an image maker. It's a branding. It's got identity because it's a landmark. And this kind of twisting form, and it's different looking at it from different directions. All of those things are things that contribute to making it a powerful form. Now, I have a hard time saying, is this primarily human factors? Is it primarily physical considerations? Is it primarily form? No. It's synthesis. It's synergy. It's doing all those things at once. It's that Game of Thrones notion of everything sort of slammed on top of each other, and it's complex. And is it singular and clear and orderly and exactly this or exactly that? No. That's more modern thinking. This one is a much richer, more complex postmodern thinking. And it does all those things actually quite well. Okay, so let's take another aspect of the building. The building is completely sheathed in copper. Very interesting material. And it's a copper, thin copper membrane that is both punctured and warped. And it's a very, very complex skin. Now, for one thing, it allows you to take all these complex shapes and unify them with this one wrapper of copper that pulls it all together. The copper is very important because it actually turns green, like the green around it, and it's a coastal area. There's salts in the air, so you get these little bits of green in it. I took these pictures when it was brand new. It's And over time, it will turn more and more and more green and more become more and more and more a part just of the landscape and the greenery that's in the park. But it also is a way of taking all the disparate pieces of the museum and bringing them together into a whole. Now, that skin is playing very much a technical role. Sometimes it's there for ventilation, and it's perforated so that air can move through it. So these are fire stairs that go up there, and rather than enclosing them, they ventilated them naturally so you don't have to heat them or air condition them. San Francisco's a fabulous salubrious climate, so they could do that, but they needed to ventilate it. So the copper can open up and become porous like that. There you can see it turning green at the edges here, and the great porosity of heavily, heavily opened up perforated metal. And it also is dimpled, as you can see here. And that's very much about physical consideration, because copper, when it's a sheet metal like that, it could warp or twist. It could, you know, not be stable. So when you dimple it, it's like corrugating metal. It strengthens the metal. So it's being strengthened by the dimpling, and then it's being perforated in order to get the right porosity. And that those two things are variables that are going across the skin all the way through the building. Sometimes it's relatively solid, as on the right here. There's basically no perforation. There just is the dimpling to give it greater strength. And then sometimes it's really pretty sparse perforation. Maybe it needs just a little ventilation back there. And so that's a different condition. And then sometimes it's wide open, and it's actually an air intake for the air conditioning or something like that. So it's got this unifying quality, but it also has this ability to respond to all kinds of issues of physical considerations required by the mechanical systems, required by natural ventilation of air, required by sun shading, because it's used as a sunshade. So it's doing all those different things. And as you go around the building, you just see this constant morphing of the perforations and the dimpling to respond to different conditions. Now, it's also very, very functional. In the slide on the right here, maybe you can barely see it, but you see that Y, you see that O. So actually the name of the museum, De Young, is spelled out by perforating and not perforating and dimpling and not dimpling, so that it actually becomes the signage for the building. It also serves many other functional purposes. It's sun shading. Sometimes it's actually veiling your view or opening up your view in different ways. So it's, again, one of those things, could I say it's all about physical considerations? No, it partly is. Is it all about function? No, but partly is. Is it a form thing? Well, of course, but not exclusively. So here we are with it as sun shading on this big open piece of glass that goes into a gallery, and it's the perforations allow some light to come in, but not too much, and reduce the glare. Here it is where it's taking in air for the air conditioning system, and here in other areas it's quite solid because that piece functionally doesn't need any opening in it. So here again, it's the synthesis, it's synergy. It's not this kind of singular thinking, but it's multiple layered complex thinking as a design method. Now, those are two completely different ways to think about how you juggle the architectural problem. Like Aalto said, that 3 o'clock in the morning feeling when you're thinking it's got to do this, it's got to do this, it's got to do this. Well, is there a way I can make it do six of those things all at once? Can I use my brain to think not so exactly rationally, but much more kind of generally, so that I'm able to synthesize those things together. And that's the way their designer brain is working in the case of the De Young Museum. So we have this elegant skin that homogenizes the building to some extent, that is able to react to different conditions, is actually in itself a very sensuous, very beautiful, timeless material that weathers really well and lasts basically forever because copper is this extremely durable material. And then you see it shimmering sometimes in the sun, and when it's wet, it looks different than when it's dry. And it's got this kind of chameleon quality that makes it interesting to look at in many different circumstances. So we have this object in the park. It is both an urban object fronting on this formal garden. It is this loose, organic, natural object that merges into the park on the other side. It slivers up little courtyards inside the museum to let in little bits of nature in the museum space itself. And that's a means of reducing museum fatigue. You know, instead of just going gallery to gallery to gallery, in this building you happen on a little garden, and then you're in the galleries again, then you're back into a little garden, and then the galleries again, and back into a little garden. It's also a way of giving natural light into the inner part of the museum without the kind of heat gain and ultraviolet light that might have been problematic in a museum. So we've been wandering around the building. Let's go inside. So you go in through this entrance on the left where the big sign says De Young right there, and go in that Sally Port. You go through that opening into one of those little courtyards that has a couple of pieces of sculpture in it. As we went in through there, that actually is the auditorium is on one side of that, and that little bridge through the Sally Port, you can see through those perforations and kind of see people walking through there, but just kind of vaguely. So when you're in the auditorium, you get a sense of the outside and of people moving, but your focus is on the speaker or the event or the screen, and you just kind of see that in the background. It's again this layered experience of space. It's not just one thing, an auditorium. I see the auditorium thing, but I'm also aware of people coming and going to the museum and the larger context of that room. So if you come in off that courtyard and you're in the main lobby space there, there is this big sculptural stair that comes up here, and you see it there with the big lobby space. There's that big sculptural stair, and it's part amphitheater. So they have events there. I went to see a dance performance there one time. So we were all sitting here and the dancers were down here. So it's a little bit of a amphitheater. It's got function to it. It also is this big kind of sculptural form in the middle of the lobby space. It's certainly got a form aspect to it. And it also is just, you know, it's a stair. It gets you from the first floor to the second floor. Completely functional that way. It's playing many roles at the same time. There's another stair, another way to go upstairs, not just one. But this one's much, you go beside the garden over here on one side, and there's a kind of more informal lilting. And now you're not in the middle of everything. So in that other stair, if you're walking up it, you're kind of on display. This one's the sort of back stair, so you can wander up there. Again, it's multiple. There's not one way to solve this problem. There's not one answer for everybody's path to get from the first floor to second floor. There's a range of different ways of doing that. If you choose, you go all the way up and you get this amazing view when you're at the top of that tower and you're seeing out to the Pacific Ocean over here and you're seeing all of San Francisco at your feet there. And it's got the perforated metal acting as a sunscreen here to reduce the glare as we look out to that stunning view. And there is, of course, display up there as well. And so, it's there for the view, but it also is giving you a view of art in a slightly different way. And also, there's just a different buzz in that gallery than in any of the others. People are talking and pointing, and it's a much more social gallery. It gives a little more range to the experience of the place. And that happens in the lower galleries as well. There's an enormous variety. There is this periodic relief out to nature over and over to reduce museum fatigue. And then there are other galleries that are very, very focused on these very precious objects. This is, they have quite a collection of artifacts from ancient cultures on South Sea Islands, South Pacific Islands. So these are little artifacts from ancient cultures, and they're in glass vitrines and they're lit very dramatically, and they seem super precious and you really focus on them. Everything else is dark around. It's the perfect way to display this particular kind of art. But then you go and somewhere else, there's contemporary art It's a very eclectic collection in the Young Museum. They have all kinds of different things. So this is like 20th, 21st century sculpture, and it's in a big, open, light, white space, skylight, views to the outside, the sculpture, so you don't have to worry so much about the ultraviolet light, and a completely different feeling because it's a different kind of art. So the room is responding very much to the variety of art that's being displayed in the museum. And then the De Young also has, as I said, it's a super eclectic collection. They also have a really good collection of early American paintings and like silver services and tea sets and accoutrement. So the galleries that show them, they're very room-like. They feel like they might be in a kind of traditional, you know, nice mansion or very nice home. And the colors are very sedate, and they have this beautiful, even light that comes from above, rich, warm wood floors. How absolutely different each of those three kinds of galleries are, because the art is different, the emotional connection to the art, the experience of the art is different, and the architecture reinforces that difference. Again, this is not that singular, ordered, you know, one-size-fits-all modern approach. It's much more collective. It's much more episodic. It's much more layered and sequential. In the end, it's an amazing art museum. And it also has become a kind of event space for the city. It is not the very best collection of art. They don't have world-class pieces of art. I would not go to that museum personally because there's some favorite piece of art that I have that's there. It's just not that good a collection. But, oh my God, it's a wonderful place for people to come together around art and to see dance performances and to see beautiful views of the city and to have a kind of extension of the life of the park in a different way. And it's the freaking architecture that is giving it that much greater prominence than the collection really could have merited on its own. I would say this is a building that does not emphasize one or a few aspects of the building and ignore others. It actually embraces all of it. Does it do it all perfectly? No. But it definitely creates a whole that is bigger than the sum of the parts. Okay, a second building. Very similar, I think, kind of approach. This one is the Thermal Baths at Valls in Switzerland by Peter Zumthor. And it was completed in 1996. This one is way, way up in an alpine village, remote from any city. And this was a little town of Valls, had been a ski resort. But in the, 1970s, 80s, all the big ski resorts began to have these, you know, mini, mini lifts and big hotels, and they got to be these cool, world-renowned places, and all the little ski resorts in Switzerland began to die out. And Valls was one of those ski resorts that they just didn't have the mega slope and the big lifts and all that, and so they started losing their business. And that was the economic wherewithal for this town. So they began to say, well, either we're going to die here, or we got to reboot ourselves a little bit. Now, another thing that was cool there was they had these thermal baths. They had hot springs. And so if you went out skiing during the day and then you would come in at night and you would bathe in these hot springs, that had always been a kind of cool thing they had to offer. Well, now they didn't have the ski thing, but they still did have these hot springs. But they realized that if you just, I mean, you can turn on the tap and get hot water. And honestly, the hot spring stuff doesn't feel that different than the hot water out of the tap. But it has got minerals in it, and it's supposed to have some spa medicinal kinds of good that it does. So, but how do we emphasize that? How do we make people get excited about coming here for that spa experience? So they hired Peter Zumthor to create a building that would make that a sensual, rich, amazing experience. And again, this is now not tapping into our logical, analytical side, but our emotional, sensual, visceral side. So he makes a building that is very much about the springs. So the building actually is set into the side of the mountain. And it is in many parts kind of cave-like. It's these dark, very enclosed, almost underground kind of vaults inside the mountain here. And from the outside, it just kind of grows out of the mountain and eventually becomes a building right here. But in earlier parts of it, it almost seems like an extension of the shape of the mountain itself. So here we are up above, and the hillside's coming down, and you can see just the green alpine terrain there. And this is just extending that green alpine terrain with a green roof on top of the building. And it's just merging and extending the nature of the landscape out into the valley between these two mountains. And then at a certain point, it becomes more prominent. It gets taller, and it lifts itself up and begins to get these incredible views of the valley and of the mountain. So at one moment, it's a cave, and you're deep inside the mountain. At another moment, you've extended yourself out of the cave, and now you're getting these big views through huge apertures out to the mountains and the valley below. It's made of this very striking stone, long, thin strips of this green stone, that it turns out this is exactly what the whole geology of this area of Switzerland is. It's this beautiful green stone. And there have been, for ages, they built little huts and little buildings out of these slates that came out of the ground, because it's sedimentary soil, so it's in layers, and when they would split it, it would be horizontal. And so he's using those long horizontal lines of the stone to emphasize the geological character, sedimentary character of that stone as he lays it up in the building. So partly we're deep in the hillside here. You actually enter the building, it's got the most inauspicious entry you can imagine. You actually go into a 1950s hotel, kind of the biggest hotel in town, and you know, you've got this lobby of this 50s hotel, and you go down a stairwell and go into the bowels of the mountain. And then you just go in a little passageway here that takes you to all these changing rooms. And these are places where you can strip off your clothes and get into your bathing suit and get ready to experience these baths. And they're the most elegantly fitted little dressing rooms with little, you know, beautiful rosewood cabinets and brass fittings. And so you take your clothes off, put them there, and then emerge out here into the baths themselves in that area. And then from the baths, you go to then this promontory, the big tall piece where you get these big views out to the Alps. So you're in the depths of the mountain and you're at the edge of the valley, and the full experience of that geography is there. So in the slide on the right, we're going down and there are little dressing rooms there on the side. And then eventually you go into the area of the baths themselves, which are these cave-like spaces, very dark, very wet, you know, incredible reverberation of sound. You hear the water lapping and reverberating there. Very, very, like you're deep, deep in the earth. And then these just little pinpricks of light that come in from above, and little bits of light down in the water below. And you've got pools that are really hot and pools that are more tepid and pools that are cold. And you're going back and forth between the different temperatures and the different pools. And it's this very wet, soft, warm kind of environment with this light dripping in that almost has a substance of its own, the thickness of the light. And so you go through that whole bathing experience, and then you begin to emerge a little bit. You see the light coming in on one side, and then there's an area where you can sun that faces the south, so you've got all the warm rays of sun. You see the big valley down there, and you can emerge, and you're out of the cave now. There's actually an outdoor swimming area that you can have outside with the big view. And all of that is again, that sort of culmination of this experience going from the depths of the earth, then slowly emerging out, and then being on the promontory looking over the valley. Now, again, I would say what he's doing here is it about function? Absolutely. There is just the most logical sequence of when I undress and when I get in my bathing togs and when I experience the water and where the hot water is, the cold. Everything's very, very function-driven in this building. And it really is about making freaking money in this little town that's been bankrupted by the fact that skiing left. So it's driven by function. It's got to make money. It's got to do what it's intended to do. And it does it extremely well. Is it about physical considerations? Absolutely. It's about the land and the land forms and extending the geography of the earth and about the nature of the stone and the sedimentary soil and the structure and how it's put together. And, you know, it's also about the solar orientation and getting the south light. And it's freaking cold there, so you want every bit of those winter, summer rays to shine on you and feel the heat of that as you emerge from the water and are getting this big alpine view. It's about physical considerations. And it's also very much about form. It's about the sensual feel of the water and the quality of the light and the contrast of light and dark, and it's all of those things, and it's all of those things all at once. It is that synergy again. The third building, again, similarly, a building that is equally about all of these things and about them all together. This one is an art museum in Kansas City. It's called the Block Building, which is an addition to the existing Museum of Art in Kansas City. The architect is Stephen Hall, and it was done in 2007. This is the existing Kansas City Art Museum. It was a building built in the 1920s, 1930s, a big kind of neoclassical building up there. And there was a big design competition, and five renowned architects, you know, asked to do a scheme for this. And the idea that the museum had in mind, there was a big kind of parking lot in the front of this building on the opposite side from here. There's a big parking lot, and they imagined that you would put the parking underground, you would build a new building there, and that would be an addition to that building. And then on the other side, away from the parking lot, there's a huge park, a beautiful, beautiful, big park. So the idea was that you just transform the parking lot into the building, put the parking underground, make a new building there. And four of the five competitors did exactly that. And they made a handsome building that would be maybe complementary to the existing building on the other side of it. But Stephen Hall had this completely different idea. He actually strung the museum through the park, kind of underground. So he put the museum all along the side of the park there, and just little bits of the museum would come up and grab a little light. But basically, the museum is lower down there, so it becomes a part of the park and of the landscape. So there you can see the existing building and the line of the landscape there, and then this little pavilion, and mostly the museum's down below. Or here, the big building, a kind of plaza. Most of the building is underground, but there are just little bits of kind of skylight that come up and pull function and light down into the building. Now, Stephen Hall referred to this as the rock and the feather. The old building was the rock. The new building was the feather, this delicate little thing that didn't try to compete with the existing building, didn't try to be a big, massive building like that at all. It just got to be little shards and pieces of smaller things scattered in the park and respecting that original building enormously. So here we see in that kind of flowing park-like setting, these little pavilions that pop up, and they're all made of glass, actually cast glass primarily, and some plate glass in them, and sort of buried into the ground there. And you see the just rolling landscape of the park, and there's pieces of sculpture and things in the park that are very much a part of the museum. And then there are these little shards and bits of things that come up in the park and house the museum as well. So there is this glass, this cast glass, that has a very interesting texture and quality to it, a very unusual kind of glass. Other than the glass, there are very few materials, but there is a little bit of concrete there. Of course, at night, that glass is lit, and these are really interesting lanterns spread through the park. And I visited there one time. I was with my brother and his wife, and he's a big baseball fan, so we went to the baseball game in the afternoon, and we came back after the baseball game just to see the building at night. And there were hundreds of people out in the park. Before this building was there, there would have been nobody in the park at night. Who goes to a freaking park at night? Now you're asking to be mugged. But this, because the building lights up like lanterns, and it feels very safe. And so then there were hundreds of people out in the park wandering around these lantern-like buildings and enjoying themselves deep in the evening. Now, he did put under where the parking was, he put the parking below ground, made a beautiful plaza and fountain above the ground, which made a great forecourt for the existing building. But this is the parking down below. And actually, the water is up above, so the light comes through the water and makes these little dappled light forms on in the parking garage. It's like a gorgeous, gorgeous parking garage. If you enter through the parking garage, you then would go up the stair and into this beautiful light lobby filled with light coming from that lantern from above, but you're actually still in the ground. There's a Sprint commercial that's been done in this space where he's talking about the future, and so somehow the building just communicates that bright kind of open future, and that brings you up from the ground and then into the galleries themselves. And the galleries are integrating in and out of the landscape. They have a great collection of Noguchi sculpture that spills out into the garden and the park and the landscape here. But mostly because galleries want a lot of wall space, and it's lit from the top, and they're beautifully lit galleries, but it's logical to put it underground in a certain way, because otherwise you've just got blank walls of museums because they need wall space. Now, there was actually, some of the curators in the museum were concerned about actually the amount of natural light that was in this building and would it spoil the paintings. And it's all very carefully controlled. But Stephen Hall made the argument that everything will look better in that natural light. You'll see colors in these paintings you haven't seen before. Curators are very skeptical. They like to control the light, use artificial light, you know. But then one of those curators, actually, he did this little video that's a testimonial, and he said, I was totally wrong. He said that we had this Mark Rothko painting, and it was in the existing building, and it was this brown painting. Mark Rothko does very dense colors in his paintings. So this is a brown painting. He said, I never realized until we got in the new museum that it wasn't brown. It was this very interesting browny purple. But until I saw it in natural light, and you get the full hues that come from natural light, I never really understood that Mark Rothko painting. So is this building about physical considerations like landscape and light? Absolutely. Is it about aesthetic form things? Absolutely. Is it about just function, just moving people through the museum, making beautiful spaces where each kind of art looks really great? It's absolutely about that too. But it does it in that complex, postmodern, synergistic kind of way. Okay, Twitter card question for today. Can you think of a building that is postmodern, that has these qualities of complexity? The kind of complexity that you would see in Game of Thrones or you would see in Breaking Bad, is there an application of that to architecture? And can you think of a building that has that kind of balance of all of these things and presented in a way that creates synergy instead of that selectivity that Paul Rudolph was advocating?